system is really going to take root, and that's where you're going to get the first philosophical political communities, the first idealist parties in a way. And then the other is Elea, and Parmenides comes from Elea, and Parmenides is really important, so Elea is really important. Elea also has Melesis and Zeno, so the Eleatics, they are a kind of mini Copernican revolution in the pre-Socratic era. But Athens will only become an intellectual hub after about 100 years into this.
I have a lot of respect for your geographical knowledge, Brandon. You certainly know more than I do about that. But I think my point was, content-wise, notwithstanding any geography, content-wise, my claim was that the emergence of democracy was a big contributing factor to this explosion of new thinking,
which
I think we would agree is the sort of the predecessor, you know, like preceded and laid the groundwork for modern rational thinking, modern scientific thinking. Mm-hmm. And so I just wanted to throw this in there, add a little bit of like political philosophy. And I want to give this, cite this as an example, this pre-Socratic revolution in thought, right? The mm-hmm. movement away from purely like God explanations or gods,
yeah.
multiple gods explanations for the phenomena that we were observed yeah. into a more of a empirical and rational way of looking at things.
And if you want to make it into
democracy, right? So I'm arguing that's one of the great advantages of democracy and freedom of expression, yeah. which we should keep in mind now. It can lead to a lot of progress.
Yeah. And if you want to make this political, before you had two classes, you had the priestly class who supplied the explanations for why the gods did particular things. Now, if you want to explain natural phenomena or anything, you don't need a priestly class to explain why this earthquake happened, or why this ship, you know, why this trade went really bad, or why this nation is encroaching on us, or something like that. So you have a democratization of that. It hasn't reached what, you know, political, legal democracy. They're still tyrannies, but you have the conditions for shared discourse. Mm-hmm. In places like Miletus and spreading throughout the Ionian coast because of the possibility for skole, or leisure time, essentially, born of wealth.
And I think something here to think about a little bit more deeply is less the appearance of democracy. And in these specific examples, you can think of the foundations of economic prosperity. We can think about the fact that this is the first time there's a shared written language and literacy is rising a lot. We can think about the advent of new technologies, which and the wide adoption of those technologies, like mathematics and astronomy, that are creating better types of sailing. And then, of course, we have military, tactical, strategic inventions, mm-hmm. Which are allowing both success in warfare, which means that these societies don't need to worry about falling to some outside invaders.
Oh, they're going to worry about that because the Persian Empire is like right.
They will, but they don't have to worry about it as much as some of their neighbors do. They're relatively speaking more advanced, and yeah. they get to keep that because they have higher degree of wealth, which is generated by these technologies and written language. It's interesting to talk about all of those things because if we think about what the preconditions for a democratic society is, or a society where you can have political equality, those things seem to be very long-standing preconditions. Like, yeah. especially if you look at the history of the United States, they had all of those things. They had a somewhat amount of technological advantage. They had access to trade, access to technology. Written language was something that was constantly being used for improvement for people within the colonies.
Yeah.
And so, I mean, like, you kind of have this diaspora of 10 colonies in early America. And then in this period in Greece, you have this diaspora of Miletus and its colonies. So you have these people who have a shared history, mm-hmm. who, yeah, but are geographically apart, and so writing allows them to communicate, but also innovate and then share those innovations. We're going a little bit off topic. I did want to talk about a work that you brought up as reading as well, Brandon, which kind of takes the other stance that the pre-Socratics are not scientific.
Yeah, so this is a work by Francis Cornford, who is an excellent classicist. It's titled, Was the Ionian Philosophy Scientific? And it's interesting, Michael, you talk about how these are scientific, and not only do they seem scientific, you go read scientific papers today and wow, they're using these explanations, so they must be scientific. But strictly speaking, they're not. There are certain things that qualify as science and certain things that don't qualify as science. And if we actually look at what the pre-Socratics did, it's actually quite unscientific. So Cornford, he gives some examples of some of the observations that the pre-Socratics make. And I'll just read this one because it's a pretty simple image. This is of Empedocles. It's not who we're talking about today, but it'll do. So Empedocles explained respiration as a process whereby the warm air breathed out through the mouth is automatically replaced inside us by cold air drawn in through pores in the chest. When the movement is reversed, the air inside, now heated, escapes through the same pores whereby it entered and is replaced by cold air inhaled through the mouth. Plato adopts this theory. No one ever thought of sitting in a bath with the water up to his neck to find out whether air bubbles could be observed passing through the water into his chest when he exhaled and out again when he inhaled, and if not, whether his breathing was impeded. You have pre-Socratics who are doing empirical things. They're looking at natural phenomena and using natural phenomena to explain other natural phenomena. They're no longer appealing to supernatural causes, but at the same time, they're still speculators, right? They are still saying the earth rests on water without going under the earth to see. They are having to, there's going to be other speculations that they make. I mean, the earthquake one is quite speculative. Did Thales go to the sea to see if when an earthquake happens, the water is shaking? Well, it would make a lot of sense that the water would be shaking while there's an earthquake going on. So it's not really a reason to think that the water shaking causes the earthquakes. So it's not scientific yet. It's not working with any kind of principle of inference, or in the 50s, Karl Popper would put forward the principle of falsifiability. But there is something, there is a move towards scientific thought.
Another very interesting part of Cornford's analysis is that he says that it is not the philosophers that are creating rudimentary experiments at this point in time. It is, in fact, the people who practice medicine. So a lot of the original ideas with regard to experimentation come from medicine. And this is argued by Cornford because there is an obvious need in medicine to create experimentation, to see the patient, find the patient's condition, their symptoms, and then diagnose and create a cure. That creates the conditions for needing some kind of, and then whether the patient is cured or not gives you kind of a scientific principle of like, this is either good or bad based off of empirical evidence.
I want to advise some caution in a claim, and you didn't make quite this strong of a claim, Brandon, but if one were to think that, oh, well, the pre-Socratics were beginning to get interested in science, but they really didn't have proper scientific methodology. So what they did really wasn't science in a technical way. I think you said that. Compared to today, right? So this is might be a claim some would make. Well, today, finally, we now have good science. We now understand what the scientific method is. I just want to advise caution around that. And I want to cite something that was just in the news just a few weeks ago. The James Webb Space Telescope revealed that at least one or even a few theories that astronomers have been operating on seem to be wrong. So one of those is that it turns out through observation using the James Webb Space Telescope that the universe is more stable than was supposed. There are less black holes than was supposed. We could Monday morning quarterback say, now we fast forward 1,000 years, right, and say back in the 21st century, they had bad science. They were making claims about the instability of the universe before they even looked. And they finally got a telescope out there and they finally realized they were wrong. I'm trying to be a little bit forgiving, perhaps more than you were, of the pre-Socratics, because with the tools they had and the sense extenders that they didn't have, they made some pretty, you know, darn good guesses, and they weren't right about everything, but they intuited some pretty they had some ideas that proved to be close.
And I absolutely agree with you. I am astounded, and I have an enormous amount of respect for the pre-Socratics and the pre-Socratic I wouldn't say that it's not scientific, but I want to say that what we now encounter, the scientific climate that we now exist in, part of that is technology. And technology emerges once we begin, you use the term sense extenders, that's a good term for it. A lot of what we can start to experiment with in science that is really revolutionary is with things like microscopes and telescopes and all kinds of instruments for measurement. The pre-Socratics don't have instruments for measurement, which takes away a bit of the arsenal for the scientific gunpowder in a way. What's really powerful about science is we can now see more than we used to see. That's what makes it really powerful. But the pre-Socratics don't have that. They're working with speculations. I agree with you. I think there is something scientific about them, and I'm willing to call it something like proto-scientific. There is definitely an optimism in natural explanations. They actually got some things pretty close, which is why I have... It's very exciting. Even for some of the things that are wrong, I'm very impressed with. Like Anaximander's idea of why the Earth doesn't move, which is about as unscientific as it gets, because you're trying to prove something that's false, right? And yet, the kind of reasoning that goes into explaining the phenomenon of, well, why isn't the Earth just shooting out from under our feet? Well, the Anaximander says the Earth is at the center of the universe, and so it doesn't have anywhere to go. That's why it doesn't move anywhere. That's brilliant, don't you think?
Well, at least they were beginning to look for naturalistic explanations and not attributing everything to the, you know, the fury of Zeus or whatever it might be. They're actually beginning a quest for knowledge. I think that's more important than whether they had it all right, yeah.
Sure, yeah.
And Cornford isn't saying that their contributions are not valuable. Rather, what he is saying is that it's a better understanding to see the philosophers as they saw themselves in this time, and that's coming out of the context of you had the poets in this culture, you had the prophets, and then you also had the philosophers. And so he's saying, like, these three groups of people used to be one group of people in the more ancient era, and then later on, like, they kind of became more specialized, and then once, you know, people became more well off, they kind of could take these different areas and kind of combine them to kind of create new areas of theory and ideas. But I think what he's trying to say is that the intellectual climate that a lot of the philosophers were in was kind of replacing or filling the gap of the seer, the priest. And so it, rather than filling the gap of the doctor, right? The philosophers and the doctors weren't competing for a job or competing for explanations. They occupied kind of two different areas of society. Now, that isn't to say that philosophers today can't be scientists and scientists can't be philosophers, or that there's no room for scientific philosophy. I was just reading a book on the history of science fiction, and that's probably one of the most interesting things to think about today is how the emergence of science fiction and the drive of America to get to the moon and all of the initiatives that went behind that in terms of encouraging and inspiring the American public to embrace science as a field and a mechanism to understand reality. that's something that was in itself a philosophy of science and has had huge effects on our modern world. So yeah, I don't know if we disagree quite that much. And I as well would agree with what Brandon said, that there's a lot to appreciate about the pre-Socratics, especially their early attempts of science. But I think Cornford's point stands still quite well, which is that the way they used science was more or less just a fanciful diversion or explanation that they came up with to impress or convince other people, not for the sake of delving into and understanding reality. And I think a lot of the reason why, well, to give a counter argument to my own point, is that they didn't have necessarily the instruments or technologies that would allow them to see those things on a deeper level. So they didn't have microscopes, they didn't have highly precision tools, and the idea of surgery that let Leonardo da Vinci understand biology at a much higher level. That being said, though, they did have a appreciation for mathematics, and so I do want to a little bit hard on them in saying, like, they are exploring these things with the logical and almost like the same idea of the language, I think, is in this early philosophy is somewhat similar to geometry, and I don't think that's an accident because it's emerging out of the same context.
Yeah.
So the idea of mathematical proof and philosophical proof existing for the purpose of convincing people and understanding something at the abstract level of ideas, and that if you can convince people of that, then and you can understand it well, that being a sufficient proof, I think that's where they were. And we shouldn't apologize for that. We should just recognize it.
At the risk of going off topic slightly, I wanted to say three things about Platonic philosophy, which of course comes after pre-Socratic, right? So Plato, but by saying these, I'll say briefly three things, which I think contrast. And by talking about Plato, I'm going to elucidate something about pre-Socratic.
Yeah, go ahead.
I see Plato in some ways as a reactionary, like reactionary to the pre-Socratics. The first way is, whereas the pre-Socratics were moving toward naturalistic explanations, as we've talked about, Plato came up with this whole thing about forms, like the supernatural idea of forms existing in some like immaterial, you know, place somewhere, which isn't even a physical place, right? So that's one way. The second way is that Plato was very critical of and skeptical of democracy. So he talked about democracy being unstable, the embroidery of many colors being attractive, but it really wasn't a desirable political system. And the third was that Plato was really very critical of, more than critical, of the sophists. So the sophists were one of the important groups, one of the important elements of pre-Socratic philosophy. And in a way, they were responsible, I would argue, for the democratization of philosophy, of the early days of philosophy, because, and maybe even responsible in part for the origins of philosophy, because they were willing to teach philosophy to anybody. Of course, they charged for it, and that's what one of the things that Plato didn't like about it, right? But more than whether they charged or not, Plato didn't like that they made philosophy available to anyone, because Plato believed that only the intellectually elite, you know, the highly educated elite people could be philosophers. In fact, they were sort of born into almost a caste of philosophy, according to Plato. And not only that, but they're the ones that should be ruling society, according to his Republic book, right? So Plato was in many ways a reaction to this early democratization of society and the naturalization of the phenomena.
That's interesting. Yeah, I never thought of the sophists as kind of democratizers or peddlers of philosophy in a way, and that, how that could be bad. I mean, that's what Socrates gets accused of doing too. He gets accused of being a sophist and of corrupting the youth, of spreading lies about Athens and its politicians and undermining trust in their authority. That's interesting. The interesting thing about the sophists is, the sophists are dealing with a kind of dichotomy at the time we know it as, you know, like nature versus nurture, but they had the idea of phusis versus nomos, nature versus convention. And the sophists play up the conventional part time and time again. So if you've read the Republic, obviously, think of Thrasymachus, who says that justice is just what anyone says it is. It's just purely conventional. The sophists are operating on a conventional sort of level, but they're also exploring that, and they're exploring language's relationship to conventions and norms. So they have philosophical contributions to make. Oftentimes people will say, so the book that we're reading is The Pre-Socratics and the Sophists. The Sophists aren't usually understood as philosophers, but they obviously have intellectual contributions to make to the history of philosophy.
Plato denigrated the Sophists in some similar way to many people now, you know, denigrate lawyers. You know, people don't like lawyers, but if you think about it, lawyers represent people that need representation. You know, they represent people that are downtrodden and oppressed and have been taken advantage of and whose rights have been violated, or they've been swindled out of money. So lawyers, you can look at lawyers in, you know, at least two ways. One way would be to say, oh, they're just sort of like sophists. You know, you pay them and they'll argue about anything. But on the other hand, you can look at lawyers and say, it's a good thing that when you need a lawyer, you can find one. You know, if your rights have been violated, you need a lawyer. So it's sort of the same thing. Plato really had a negative view of sophists, and he didn't like the democratization of intellectual thinking and of philosophy.
I do also think it's important to note that because we're dealing with a period of history that's over several hundred years, these terms are not going to have concrete meaning for the whole time span. They will be evolving. They will be changing as the field of philosophy develops, as thinking develops, as the world physically changes and cities rise and fall and groups rise and fall. We're not going to have, like, what if we tried to set out to say, you know, these were the sophists, this is what they believed. Yeah. And then we try to apply that to one time period 100 years before and another time period 100 years after. That's not, I don't think that's accurate to reality. So I think it's worthwhile to, I think, allow for a bit more nuance in terms of as we continue looking through the pre-Socratics and the early sophists, those people might be entirely different than their later disciples.
Yeah.
But I guess that's kind of something that we'll also be getting into, is whether or not a teaching actually ends up in teachers being like students being like their teachers, or whether it leads to something entirely different.
Well, the thing about terms with the pre-Socratics is that the pre-Socratics are really the first place that a lot of these terms are being used. In fact, this is the emergence of the field where the discourse is happening at all. We're not jumping in right at the we're not jumping in the middle. We're starting right at the beginning. So we get to, that's the really exciting opportunity of studying the pre-Socratics, is you get to trace the meaning of these terms right from the beginning. When the Milesians are studying the cosmos, that means something a little different than it does with the Pythagoreans, sure, but you also get to see the way that those meanings influence one another, the way that they emerge out of the same usage. You get to understand the particularities of it, but you kind of start fresh. When you're studying the way that the Milesians look into phusis, nature, natural explanations, it starts right there. It starts with the first arche, water, and then it moves into Anaximander's Aperon and whatnot. So that's really the exciting opportunity that we have to read the pre-Socratics. It's the very beginning. Again, there's still baggage with words and whatnot, and as philosophers go on, they will mean different things, but that's why we read each of them. That's why we read them against each other. We'd be responsible about our readings with them.
And as we've been as we've been talking about on our other series on biological versus cultural evolution, this is, I think, a very interesting case study of cultural evolution. This, like, we're literally watching the Greek culture evolve in its in basically real time as we're reading the pre-Socratics.
One more thing before we end, you guys, I just want to put some perspective on this, lest we become too ethnocentric here, because we're talking about, you know, like the beginnings of philosophy, as though Western philosophy was all philosophy. But I just wanted to put some perspective on this, and I'm looking at a time line here, and around this same time, there also existed in the world pre-Columbian civilization of Central and South America, ancient Israel, China, there's ancient Indian civilization, ancient Egyptian civilization until about 300-400 BC, and even ancient Mesopotamia coexisted at the same time as at least part of the time of these pre-Socratics. So I have a hunch that there was a lot of other philosophy going on. And there's also North American indigenous people who had been in North America for like over 20,000 years, even before this. So,
oh yeah,
I think there's a lot of philosophy going on in the world. So we're talking about the history perhaps of Western philosophy, which is relatively new on the scene.
Yeah. I mean, things have been going on for a while. It's a very exciting time. People are thinking all over the place, but the Greeks kind of want in on it too. And they've started doing philosophy for themselves in the town of Miletus. And so, and that, you know, that little thought that they had there had a pretty big impact. Yes, it's not the only one, of course.
One development of one civilization and world history has many, many civilizations. There's a very long Chinese tradition of philosophy, and also in India there's another very long written tradition, and in Mesoamerica we know they had very advanced astronomy.
So you've been listening to the Canadian Philosophy Show. I've been your host, Brandon, and joining me is Michael Robert Keditz and Aaron Wang. This has been the first episode of our Pre-Socratics series. Thank you for joining us. Bye for now.
You can find the Canadian Philosophy Show at tcps.podbean.com and on Apple Podcasts and Spotify. Please email us at hello@philosophyshow.ca.
listen to music.